Welcome to yet another episode of Shortcast Over Coffee. Today, my guest is Rukmini S. Rukmini is an independent data journalist based in Chennai. Rukmini and her team have built dataforindia.com, that is dataforindia.com, which aims to expand everyone's understanding of India through the data. The project takes public data and makes it usable and helps its consumers derive descriptions and insights about the country. She has also authored the book Whole Numbers and Half Truths, What Data Can and Cannot Tell Us About Modern India. In this episode, I will talk to Rukmini about the monumental effort behind Data for India and why it is important to do now, her experience working as data journalist in newsrooms, and the challenges faced along the way during the building of the project. Please do like, share, and subscribe this podcast, Shortcast Over Coffee, on top podcast platforms like YouTube, Spotify, Apple, etc. Now, without further ado, let's get right into the episode. Hi, Rukmini. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Great. We will talk in depth about your latest venture, Data for India. But before that, let's start with who Rukmini is. I know you are a data journalist, but for someone who does not know the difference between a journalist and a data journalist, how is a data journalist special?
Yeah, so data journalist is it's one of those jobs that I think 10 years ago when I first started doing this, I had to universally explain to everybody what it meant, while now at least some people, younger people in particular, get it. So I think my journey through it has also been the sort of, mainstreaming of data journalism in India. Essentially, data journalism is journalism. It's very much located within journalism, follows the same rules of journalism, which is, and it is separate from opinion in that respect. The idea is to talk about the world or the part of the world that you're looking at using numbers and statistics. So, for example, if this is election season and, you know, most political reporters would report on it by going to a constituency and talking about candidates, while a data journalist might choose to enter that same conversation through numbers. So they might look at the development indices of a constituency and use it to talk about the record of the incumbent, or they might look at political data and try and talk a little bit about representation. So again, it follows the same rules of journalism, but the starting point is a piece of data, typically numbers and statistics. I think what's happened in the last 10 years is that data journalism has become very much a sort of essential part of most newsrooms. I think all English newsrooms in India and many non-English newsrooms now have at least one, if not a whole team of dedicated data journalists. So in many ways, I think part of what I am doing right now, which is a move more towards data communication than journalism. I don't see myself as being part of the media as such anymore. In part, it is because of a feeling of satisfaction that that a baseline of data journalism now exists across Indian newsrooms. So I don't see that as my job anymore. There's many people doing it very well. And now what I'm interested is in finding ways to not just democratize access to data, but also to make sure that the understanding of the country that should come from that data happens in a much more intentional way, that it's not something that you just hope happens as a byproduct of what you're doing, but your focus becomes making sure that that knowledge of the country is there, is happening as a result of the numbers, and is reaching more people. So that's sort of been my journey in and out of data journalism. I started off as a regular newsroom reporter. I went to a journalism school in Bombay and joined the Times of India after that. So my journey to data journalism too was through a newsroom and then into writing about numbers specifically. And you know, as I've said before, I have no training in data. I have no training in maths or statistics or even econ. So it's very much something I learned on the job.
Yeah, that's was going to be my follow-up question, is how important is a background in math and statistics to data journalism? And do you think you missed out on something by not having a proper, you know, schooling in data or statistics?
I think so, yeah. So when I tell people, especially younger journalists, I do like to tell people this, that I don't have a background in this. And I do like to tell people that I don't think it should be a barrier to data, to getting into data journalism. A lot of the people who, you know, younger journalists, as well as people in journalism schools who I meet, are people from the quote unquote arts background who have left math a long way behind, often people with a fear of numbers. And it's not just that I want readers with the fear of numbers to feel that this is something they can get over, and numbers are not as intimidating as, you know, your fifth grade maths teacher made them seem. But I want to tell journalists this as well. And I think particularly women journalists, journalists from marginalized backgrounds are even more likely to have left math behind a long time ago. And I don't think it should be a barrier. It is something you can teach yourself. It is something you can learn on the job. All that said, I don't mean this as a humble brag that, you know, I do just fine without a background in it. I do think I missed out by not having both econ and math is something I wish I had, you know, studied more. And I would encourage people looking, hoping that this is going to be part of their future, to do it. I think there's a lot more resources that are available right now, but which help you sort of fill in the gaps in your knowledge. I also benefit enormously from having a team. So working in teams where other people fill in these gaps in your knowledge. But yes, it is something that would have been good to add to my skill set.
Yeah, and the reason why I ask this is because a lot of people who take up journalism in school or in profession, as a profession, a lot of the times they are running away from math. They hated mathematics in school, or they just never felt comfortable. And I felt like some of the things that comes naturally to some people need not come as naturally to some others. So the way an engineer or someone who is passionate about science and math sees numbers is completely different from someone who likes to be a journalist or wants to be an investigative journalist. But however, having said that, I think the fact that you could make your way into being a data journalist is a proof that, you know, you don't really need to be intimidated by numbers. You can embrace them, and, you know, you could do just fine.
Yeah, so I think in some ways that has been actually an advantage for me, which is because I have always written for general interest newspapers and now for a general interest platform, it helps to slowly piece through the numbers to make sense of them, because that is how most people process them and read them. So I have occasionally read columnists and sometimes, you know, even bloggers who are much more advanced mathematicians and statisticians writing about numbers and, you know, using regression analysis and similar things. I don't think, unless it's written very well, I think it often does not translate well to readers. And there the missing link is the writing, because if you do write well, you can communicate these things well. But I think, as you said, these are not always necessarily skill sets that go together. So I think being a lay person working through numbers helps me write for lay people working through numbers. So I think there is that advantage. Things that I find surprising or feel that have needed an explanation to me, things like what a particular measure means, and things that are assumed but still seem surprising to you. So, you know, whether it is some rates being standardized by 100, some rates being standardized by 100,000, because I have had to pay very close attention to those to figure them out, they in themselves become points of fascination or interest to then try and convey to other people. So I think when they are not statistical concepts that you sort of glaze over because you've read a long time ago and you already know what they mean, then you're actually having to figure it out, and that makes it all the more meaningful to you. So this is not a mathematical concept, but I think One of the things that came to me once was when I was looking at crime statistics, and there was this thing that I stumbled upon, which is one of the ways that India produces crime statistics is by following the principal offense rule, which is if an FIR has multiple sections of crime, only the one carrying the highest possible charge is used. And the statistician explaining it to me said, this is because there would be double counting. Otherwise, there would be double counting. Now, I needed to really stop him and fully try and understand how that would work. And I think that helped. So, of course, that seemed crazy to me. And I think that helped really convey that much more in a more sort of what it actually means, right, beyond the concept or the notion over there. So yeah, that is an advantage. And I think fundamentally data journalism and communication is built on clear communication. The numbers are the what you're using to tell the story, but what gets it across really is clear communication, and clear and good engaging. Just clear is not enough. I'm not gripped by clear communication. I want to be told an engagingly told piece of information. And so those again are skills that you can develop, and then at some point you either have or you don't. That again helps you sort of bridge some of the other gaps that you might have in your skill set. So yeah, in fact, I don't think it's fair to often make journalists feel, or people who want to get into data feel that they're lacking in something by not, it's not just math. Now there'll always be, you don't have R or Stata in your skill set. Are you able to do, what are you going to be able to do with the numbers? I mean, I think we should be equally worried about very well qualified engineers applying who simply cannot write engagingly. I don't think that might be an even harder skill actually to teach. So teams are great, and teams produce great work. We fill in the gaps in each other's work. These are skills I would have liked to have, but so taking a large NSSO report and sort of slowly reading it to try and understand what it means that over time you build such familiarity with the language of the NSSO that you're able to quickly pick up what's gripping, what's new, what the story is there, which were things that mattered more in journalism. Now I'm a little less concerned with news imperatives.
Yeah, and I think you summed it up pretty well in the sense that that's why a team effort is so important, right? An engineer will bring a different set of skill set. A clear writer with a background in data will bring their own unique set of skill set, and that's what makes it all unique. Rukmini, you have come up with this incredible website. I got a chance to look into whatever it has. I know it's going to grow in numbers and in the kind of areas that it's going to cater, which is dataforindia.com. You have been a data journalist for quite a while, and you have also authored some remarkable books in the past. But why did you think that this was an important thing to do, and why now?
So thank you for that, and thanks for the kind words for Data for India. And just as we spoke about teams mattering, it's a team that's built it. It's the Data for India team that's built it, and I'm very proud of the work that they've done. It's a tiny team that's built something really that we're all really proud of, and we're proud to see we're proud to take it forward as well. So I think two things happened in the last couple of years. I moved into freelance writing after being in newsrooms for a while, and then wrote the book in 2021, which was in a way trying to pull together insights and learnings from nearly 10 years of data journalism. And the idea was to bring together both what good data can tell us, as well as what my field reporting experiences, as well as conversations with experts and others, showed me that the data was missing. So in a way, the quantitative and qualitative together. part of the reason I had never thought of the book, I mean, when someone suggested it to me, I really had to stop and think about it and asked a few people if it made sense. It honestly had never occurred to me, is because I've always been in newsrooms surrounded by journalists, feeling that we are talking about this and writing about this every day. Why do we need to again write it in a book? So if there were, you know, all the book builds on all of my reporting. So there was, to me, almost the feeling of, well, I've done the reporting and it's out there and it's been in newspapers, it's been published. These are not unknown or unsaid things. Why write it? But I think there was finally a point of realization that that this was disappearing into the ether, and the public understanding that should have come as a result of not my journalism alone, but what so many of us have done for the last 10 years had not happened. It had not accrued, it had not accumulated, it had not attached itself to the public conversation in a way that it should have. So every time journalists feel a sense of frustration that how is it budget season again and people are still calling themselves middle class when they're clearly not, you can feel frustrated and annoyed at people's maybe attention spans or what they're reading or the bubbles that they're in, or you can feel frustration at the very imperatives and the very sort of structure of the news. And that is, I think, the end to which I have come to, because all of the conversations with people that I've had after the book as well just show me so much desire in people to know more, to try and often challenge their own priors, to understand the country better. And if what we've been doing in journalism is not having that effect, then maybe this isn't the best delivery mechanism. Maybe incentives are not aligned to make this happen. So the book was one such step of trying to accumulate what we should know by then. And I think the direction that it took me in after that is that I wanted to build public goods. I think after 10 years of data journalism, if someone had approached me wanting to fund what I was doing next, there was a point where I thought I wanted to do more and more ambitious news reporting. So I wanted to get more money to build teams to do more tech-driven, more better designed, beautiful, large pieces of data journalism. I had a few ideas in mind. I had people I wanted to approach for data. I had people I wanted to hire. That was sort of what I had in mind. But I think at some point there came the realization that wasn't what I wanted to solve for. It wasn't a problem and it didn't need solving and it didn't need me. And what I did want to solve for was this lack of shared understanding about basic socioeconomic issues that comes not as a result of intentional polarization or refusal to look at facts, but as a result of the difficulty in accessing this information. That if two friends are arguing in a bar about what the level of migration in India is, if there's nowhere short of Wikipedia that you can go for it, then you cannot blame them for one of them leaving there thinking that migration is very uncommon and the other one thinking migration is much more common than it actually is. So, yeah, I think the term public goods has been like a lightning rod. It sort of helped frame what I want to do, what I think is missing, what feels fulfilling. And so, then the idea of coming together with my co-founder and a team to try and build public goods that do three things together, give people insights and an understanding of the country that is not based on cherry-picked data, that is beautifully visualized in shareable charts, and for which the underlying data exists right over there with free access to them, to bring these three things together and to build public goods out of it. That's what we finally landed on as our mission.
I was talking to Krish Ashok for another episode of my podcast, and one of the things that he told me is that India, in over the years, has never been a very documentation-driven country, you know, ever since how the Vedas were passed on from generations to generations, or even, let's say, Hindustani music or Carnatic music was passed on. It was all like, you know, orally
transmitted. Oral traditions.
Yeah, oral yeah. traditions. So, do you see that mindset or that push for documentation changing? You know, because you have been in this industry or sphere for over 10 years, are we still there yet? Because a lot of the Western countries have always had this mindset of documentation, right? So what are your thoughts on that?
No, I absolutely agree that it's a huge missing area. I mean, one of the reasons, so when we first started talking about what we wanted to build, many people within this community would respond with, oh, but isn't so-and-so already doing it, or so-and-so already doing it? And I think what's happened is just unconscionable replication of efforts repeatedly by different people over the years, because what was being built was, what was being done was work typically for research papers or on occasion work for proprietary products. And it wasn't, and that's fine. I mean, I don't think everybody needs to build public goods, and I don't hold it against anyone for that. But what it has meant is that commons, shared knowledge around these things has not been well documented. And so everybody replicates the work on their own systems. In a way, I feel that there's probably several thousand, you know, desktops across the country on which a version of our backend exists. Maybe not in the same way, but people have done essentially the same thing, which is you take unit level data from large household surveys and you try and clean it up and do things with it. It's unfortunate that we've not come together to be able to share things. There, of course, there are many great initiatives. So the most sharing, giving, wonderful community of open data users in India is Data Meet, that I've been part of for more than 10 years now, which is really it's a Google group, and it's just a fantastic community where people share open data resources. I think anyone trying to build anything that requires shape files of Indian states and districts that often change would know Data Meet very well, from that being absolutely a go-to resource. So that's a fantastic effort. I think we've seen some great recent initiatives as well. One of the most sort of, you know, really one of the silver linings of the pandemic, and in terms of data in particular for me, was this COVID-19India.org group that came together, an entirely volunteer-driven pro bono effort that was just a bunch of people coming together on Telegram and saying, let's take official Indian bulletins, put them together and make them usable and searchable for people. There wasn't crowdsourcing of data. There wasn't, you know, anything else. It was just, this exists in multiple places, let's bring it together. And also that it was put together at a, you know, in a way that at a quality and scale that made it actually enjoyable to use. So I think typically data portals have been so clunky that it's really that spoonful of medicine thing, that you're going to have to navigate them just for the data that you want. But something like a COVID-19India.org, and now even the Government of India's NDAP, National Data Analytics Platform, have taken that next step to make things so much more usable that it doesn't feel like that's the end of your afternoon. So I think those sorts of initiatives did have sort of given us a blueprint for how to pull these things together. The desire of the community to come together to help each other is enormous. I've never been in doubt of that, but perhaps we've not been able to figure out how to, or we've not sort of done this before, which is build a common resource for what multiple people are doing separately. So even in terms of documentation, it's funny, it's something we've been talking about in the last couple of days. There are often clear errors in government surveys, data sets, reports. And it is just, you know, inside baseball knowledge. There is no way, there's no sort of shared resource to be able to tell people, listen, figure on page 120, figure 10.4 on page 120 has all the labels in the pie charts are one off. So don't look at the pie chart, look at the table before that, because if you look just at the pie chart, you're going to produce a totally wrong number. I think we have lacked that sort of documentation effort, not just in terms of errors, of course, but also in terms of what you can do. I think so at the individual level, there are a lot of people always willing to help. The minute we get stuck with something, there are five people I can email and they will be able to help us and, you know, figure that out. But yeah, even this process, so what we've built is one thing, but documenting all of this and creating a sort of almost like oral history, but not oral history, documented oral history of Indian socioeconomic statistics is maybe it's happening as a byproduct of what we're doing, but it needs to happen more widely. It is truly such a shared joy and shared pain that it needs to be brought together and documented better. And again, there is Data Meet, there is individual GitHubs across India and the world on which people have made data, digitized it, shared it, made it widely usable. So the community is absolutely wonderful and very helpful and very public spirited. But how to pull it all together to make it an easily accessible resource from those not on Data Meet or not familiar with all of this is something that's evolving.
Yeah, I can totally see how the public is super enthusiastic, because your tweet about this project went viral. I mean, the kind of comments that the tweet received is quite remarkable. So the idea is to not just have data, but also provide valuable insights with good visualization and good insights on the platform. I think that's sort of the idea.
Very much that. In fact, we're very clear that we're not a data portal. So we don't, this is, if you want to look for a particular data set, then NDAP is where you should go, or there are other resources as well. We are not a data portal. We are a place to come to try and understand the country through data. But being, producing that credibility from end to end, an important part of it to us is making the data available as well. So it's us showing our homework as well as creating a resource for other people to use to do what they want with it. We don't want to hoard this information or this data. But yeah, so the data is sort of almost step three and not step one in this, step one very much is descriptions and insights into the country.
Yeah, you mentioned about public good earlier in this episode. So when you were building this with your co-founders and the team, did you think about who your potential consumers of this would be?
So because this is a free platform and will be in perpetuity, we think of it more as who users will be and to build well for them. We imagine this as being at a few different levels. We very much want it to be used by the curious public. So it should not require a level of knowledge about public policy or econ to be able to get into it. And very much that sort of feeling that if you had a question in your mind about any socioeconomic issue in India, you should be able to come here to answer it for yourself through what the data can tell you. And that is why building to scale over time is going to be important for us, because it shouldn't just be here are the two things that Rukmini thought of this week, but it should be here is any question that I have that I can come to find an answer to. And really our idol in this respect is our World in Data. We're very upfront about how much we admire them and how much we thought of them while building this, and we are in touch with them as well. They know about the project too. So the way I know that now, if I want to look at any key international development issue, I can go to Our World in Data and find something on it. We do want to become that sort of go-to resource. And again, that is one of the ways in which we differentiate ourselves from news. In any case, this is not news. There is nothing new you're going to find over here. We're building knowledge resources and not news. Neither is the writing in any way newsy. But the other part over here is that it should not be what me or my team want to tell you, but for you to be able to answer questions you have in your mind. So that analogy about, you know, two friends having a debate in a bar really is one of the ways we think about it, which is we often, and as someone working in data, I frequently get texts from friends or even my parents' friends who say, oh, I was having an argument with someone on a WhatsApp group about this, and what is the actual number? So, or what is the actual state of information? So we would want people to be able to come here and answer it for themselves. That's one. Secondly, we really hope for it to become a good teaching resource. So we know that a lot of teachers, school, college, say to their students, don't use Wikipedia. And now they might say, don't use ChatGPT. But we want them to be able to say, do use Data for India. And the reason to use Data for India is because we want to have proven credibility and rigor. So don't use it because of some legacy issue or who has built it, but use it after trying it out and being convinced that this is not partisan, this is not cherry picked, and this shows integrity and fidelity to the actual underlying data and advances your knowledge. So we want it used both as a teaching resource as well as students doing their research. And then we imagine it'll be useful for people doing actual sort of research. So if it is whether at the public policy level, someone preparing a presentation, and even within the private sector, we know that a lot of decision making does hinge on a broad understanding of how socioeconomic issues play out in the country. I think the data sources that many in the private sector turn to are often not great. They sort of modeled their data adjacent rather than being data driven fully because of how difficult it is to access government data. And so we're hoping to make all those pathways more clear to people.
Yeah, I think you mentioned in like the first sentence of Data for India that the aim is to expand everyone's understanding of India through the data. And you sort of zero in on a few aspects of socioeconomic scenario in India, which are like population, health, living conditions, economy, and work. This must have been quite a monumental effort, because every time I read an article or a description of data, I see, 10 to 12 citations right below it, and all of them seem to be extremely long report. So how did you pull it off? Did it take a lot of hours, or how did you manage to break it down? Because, let's say I read or I look at a 500 page document, I am kind of all over the place. Where do I start? Do I start with the table of contents and sort of make my way through what is to be done first, what is to be read first? So how did you break it down? Because to me, when I look at it, each article or each insight that you provide is like a PhD project in itself.
So I think it's a combination of two things. One is just accumulated knowledge that's come from doing this for 10 plus years, which is, so I'm not reading these afresh, but imagine it as if you read an NSSO report every day for the last 10 years, the way someone who's writing about a particular writer reads them all the time and then can tell you a little bit about their worldview, almost the writer's worldview from it, even if no book talked about the writer's worldview, right? That's essentially been the process for the last 10 years. So I think what that's allowed me and my team to do is that we're able to produce a framework of what we know that existing numbers can tell you about a particular topic. Then the extremely, extremely hard and important part of it, and what took up most of last year essentially, has been bringing the data in itself. Because it's one thing to know what it says, and then it's quite another to have the data there and to be able to build charts of it. So that just required very extensive tech and data work to make that happen. And then I think we really do make sure that we go in with a questioning attitude and not with the assumption that we know what the answer is already. I think another thing that I've often, you know, found something that sort of really sort of put me off a lot of writing and research in the last few years in particular has been the sense that there is a bit of a stagnation in imagination around the questions that are asked. So you can expect to read about the same 2-3 dimensions, but maybe with different points of view around most topics. And when you go, when you look at the data in more detail, especially from the unit level, you realize that there are so many more dimensions that you could be looking at around it, but that there's just been a sort of limitation of imagination perhaps in that. So I think going in with the sort of humility that we don't know the answer, we're actually asking the question, does allow us to come up with things that are then surprising, not just to us, but insightful to others as well. So yeah, I think it's a combination of accumulated knowledge and then really deep tech and data work, particularly in the last year.
Yeah, I think this is something that you kind of alluded to earlier, is that, you know, I have all this accumulated knowledge as a part of newsrooms, etc. And how do I sort of bring all of that together? And I think with your book and this project, you sort of brought them all together.
And it's also very much that I'm tapping into other people's accumulated knowledge. So, you know, if you're writing about something like fertility, there are 10 people who have all of these great insights into broadly how things have changed. And then it's either there in individual research papers or it's a project that they're working on. But how do we tap into all of that to build something that everybody can look at? So it's very much not just my learnings in the last 10 years, but tapping into other people's learnings as well.
Yeah, and also with data, it's also like, you know, continuous refinement or continuous improvement, right? We might not have the most perfect data to begin with. Sometimes I feel like any data can be countered by some other data. You know, that's been how, what my experience has been, is that, you know, like women under 30 are more underpaid than men of the same age, but it only happens to white people versus colored people. So it's so nuanced, and some of the edge cases and some of the sort of micro subdivisions of that data might give us a completely different picture.
So I think there was a point where I used to feel this, that everything can be countered, and so, you know, what do you say? Where are you left with? But I feel very differently about it now, which is, if you bring in all of those opposing, if you look, first of all, properly without having allied yourself morally, politically, whatever, with one side or the other, if you're really looking at them all, you are able to, and you're, you know, willing to deal with nuance and uncertainty. You do not feel like you have to be the oracle giving the ultimate answer. There is a way to pull it all together. So just as an example, one of the things that we've been, that we will encounter a lot and have already in a couple of our pieces, is the sort of gap that exists between survey data and administrative data. So what this means is, administrative data usually comes as a almost byproduct of schemes, and what you get through the operation of the scheme, you will know how many taps have been installed or how many bathrooms have been built. And what you'll know from survey data is what people say about their use, whether they're using bathrooms or getting water or not. And this gap between the two has often led people to be allied with one side or the other. So then, typically, because survey data tends to show slightly lower access, it means that people in opposition to the government at the time will usually ally themselves to that and say it's showing that schemes are not reaching people. And people typically at that time allied to that government will attach themselves to administrative data. I think when we talk about being nonpartisan, it's not out of some, you know, it's not something to just write or to just have as a principle. It is truly out of the sense that if you show integrity to the data, these are not partisan positions, because what does emerge is that there is a gap between the two. That gap has explanations, and there is something to be learned from both sides. And I don't mean both sides of people, both data sets. And if what we're genuinely interested in is to try and understand the landscape of, say, water, we're going to need to look at both, and we're going to need to pull all of that together to a nuanced and maybe slightly messier notion of what water looks like. I think among the very polarized or the very political, there is sometimes a active desire to not engage in this nuance. Among many other people, there is a discomfort with uncertainty. If you're saying this also, then that also, then what is the answer? Is it high? Is it low? Is it not? Is it a good story? So that's also something that happens. Even people who don't intend to be very polarized do it when they can't deal with this uncertainty. We don't feel any restrictions of the number of data sets we use, about where we land at the end of it, about the length of what we write, about the number of footnotes, about explanation of methodology. None of these limit us. We can write as much as we want. We can write about a whole data set and explain why it's being used. We can decide not to use some data sets, as we are right now, when we find that they are just not correct, and we'll write about that as well. We'll explain it. Because we're able to accommodate both in terms of thinking and in terms of actual space, so much more messiness, it allows us to engage with all of this. So I no longer feel sort of stuck between this says this and that says that, and does that leave me nowhere? But really at the place of, it leaves me somewhere when I look at both together. So it, you know, I've said that in the book as well, is that there is a messiness to the country that journalism tries to paper over, academia also sometimes tries to paper over, which we just have to get more comfortable with dealing with. How is it that people are saying that they want to vote for development, but then they're also voting for people, only will vote for people of the same caste? Yes, you can hold both ideas together. You need to hold both ideas together if you want to get anywhere closer to what decision making is actually like, rather than some sort of trope of what a voter is.
Yeah, I think being open to messiness is also a good indication that probably every data has its own story to tell, right? And sometimes the more the data, the merrier, and you can always learn from one data set over the other. I think it's safe to say that you probably changed or you probably refined yourself in believing that. You know, even if two different data sets have contradicting takes, both may be important and both may be necessary to help us understand the nuance and sort of come up with more insights.
Right. And in the understanding of why they are different or saying different things, a lot emerges. Sometimes it will be who was asked the question, and maybe that explains some of the difference. Sometimes it is which year. If you asked it in 2021, when most people were back home, maybe that changes things. So it's not just that, it actually produces more information to get into why these things are different. It's just this embrace of messiness that's important.
Yeah. You mentioned that some of the data is from administration, some of it is from surveys. And to me, a lot of the data can possibly come from qualitative analysis, right? So, and qualitative analysis usually uses subjective judgment, you know, usually is based on like soft and non-quantifiable data. And because qualitative data involves intangible or inexact information, it can lead to biases, or it can lead to, us as consumers of data go on a completely different tangent. So how do you make sure that qualitative data is, I guess it's difficult to have it unbiased, or do you just collect everything from everywhere?
So we are not using qualitative data for DFI, and typically I don't work with a lot of qualitative data either. I know that this is sometimes, a suggestion or comment that I often get from people working in the social sciences, which is that there's so much qualitative work that you're not looking at and you should. I think for myself, typically not for DFI, but for myself, I have tried to use reading qualitative work to fill gaps in my understanding of quantitative work. So in the book too, for example, I look at quantitative data on meat eating, and then I have a couple of, I have some conversations which do suggest that the person I speak to in the book, she says, for sure, if someone came home to interview my mother and grandmother and asked them about meat eating, they would say they don't eat meat. They do, and they're a scheduled caste family. So reading studies like that, and I read them often when I come across them, help me put the quantitative data I'm seeing in context. Could it be that the numbers that we have on meat eating are an underestimate? I don't think that this qualitative study or story comprehensively changes those numbers, but it makes me, it introduces elements of uncertainty that I think are important. I don't think it's necessary to infantilize readers and make them feel that what you have in this table is a certain and complete description of the world. I think it's okay to say, this is what the survey says. Some people could be not reporting it. That doesn't mean other people could be over-reporting. No idea. I cannot, claim that changes the number or to what degree. But that is typically how I have looked at qualitative data, to help improve my understanding of the country and to help put the numbers I'm seeing in context. But I haven't, I don't have a good mental model of how it would work either in my reporting or my work, and definitely not for DFI.
And I think that's a good and a fair policy to take as well, because qualitative data is often biased, and also it involves tremendous amount of groundwork. And who knows, the person who did the groundwork may be biased themselves, and people may, like you said, may want to answer something, but they just cannot because of socioeconomic problems and all of that. So yeah,
though it is important to remind ourselves that the likelihood of bias or difficulties in data collection exist with quantitative data as well. And these two are sometimes documented, and I find it extremely interesting to read about people's surveying experiences. In fact, I wish the government of India would do more talking about its surveying process, have their enumerators do interviews, take journalists along when they're doing the surveys, because it produces such fascinating insights. So the political scientist and demographer Sonali Desai leads the National Council for Applied Economic Research and University of Maryland's India Human Development Survey, which is a large nationally representative household survey that is currently in the field. Third round is in the field. And she had such a fantastic Twitter thread sometime last year, where the number one question in any survey is typically about the household, who is in your household. And you would think that is something you spend 6 seconds on and move on to the rest of the stuff. But she was talking about how complicated the notion of a household can be. Someone slept here the previous night but doesn't usually sleep here. My daughter lives in a hostel, but how can I say she's not part of my household even though she stays there? Elderly parents who eat one night in one son's house, sleep one night in the other son's house. None of these are, without elements of subjectivity, or one could call it bias. And then if the enumerator is likely to be someone showing empathy to these sorts of situations, perhaps it is a messy household situation, and then the way the enumerator presents themselves matters to what the person admits to. All of that matters enormously in the collection of quantitative data as well. So I don't want to make it seem as if there are particular failings of qualitative data that quantitative data is insulated from. Again, it's part of the process of dealing with messiness to be able to tell readers that we're writing about all of this quantitative data. However, there is a possibility that some things are being missed or got wrong.
Yeah, I completely agree. And one area where maybe somewhat of a clean data can be obtained is from corporates like Amazon, Flipkart, these delivery companies. But again, these are corporate data and not public data. Do you think you're missing out by not getting, you could have probably gotten so much insights on how people buy, what is the purchasing power, and how does the purchasing change as people move through economic levels in society? Are you working towards getting maybe some of that data from corporations, and have you approached them? What has been their response?
So when I wrote the book and when I was in newsrooms, I would often talk to, so I was particularly interested in the big tech companies and getting data from there. And it was very, made very apparent repeatedly that that sort of data, that data, and I want to repeat that what I sought was anonymized data, so it wasn't a privacy issue here. It was not forthcoming, and it would only come in sort of press releases when a particular point was being sought to be made. I think there have been a couple of notable exceptions. So Facebook has a wealth index that it makes data available for. Google mobility data was very valuable during the pandemic. It was made available. It isn't anymore. So there have been, some chinks in the armor from time to time. I think if there is going to be a sharing of this data, it's going to have to come through some sort of compact that the people and companies enter into. So I think what happens is usually privileged access. There are researchers who enter into arrangements with big tech companies, but also with state governments or government agencies where they get access to the data. And we are not always privy to the full details of what that arrangement involves. These typically are not papers that produce negative outcomes for the either the tech company or the state agency. So it seems safe to assume that there are some restrictions on what can be put out. So to avoid that sort of privileged access route, there is going to have to be some sort of social compact where we come together with people and tech companies to come to some understandings of what data, like Google mobility data that was made available during the pandemic, what are other streams of data that could be made more regularly available to writers and researchers. The first step of any survey typically tends to be to make sure that it is nationally representative. So any of this data would have to start from a process where you're able to place it in the larger frame, which is not to treat it as a universe on its own, but as a share of the universe, and to understand how this share relates to the universe. So I'm not comfortable using, no researcher or data journalist is going to use Facebook data to tell you that this is how things work in India. That sense first of what slice of the country Facebook users occupy is a first and pretty complicated step to do. So there's a lot of work to do even after getting access to some of this data. I can see it happening in the future. I do feel that there is an element of public spiritedness in conversations that I have with executives in some of these companies, just not in a way where I'm seeking data, but just people who are interested in broad improvement of access to data. So I can see it happening. I'm not sure I'm the one to make that happen. Someone will do it, I'm sure. The principle I'm broadly interested in is to make sure that it isn't privileged access. The way, like in journalism, the incentive is, hey, build a source at Facebook and try and get them to give you access to X data. I'm not interested in that. I want to try and think about how we can come together more broadly.
Yeah, do you think regulations can maybe push them to share anonymous data?
So regulations can push them to share data that is you know, essential for regulatory reasons, or perhaps even some broad democratic outcomes, but for the sort of you know, insight into the way the country works, information that we're interested in, I don't see regulations as the route there. But I do see, I don't know, I do imagine that conversation and sort of could be a route there. I do sense a desire to be able to plug into globally, to be able to plug into research, to be able to plug into an advancement of knowledge about how things work. But there will need to be a structure and a pathway to it, and I don't think I'm best placed to do that.
Yeah. In your book, What Data Can and Cannot Tell About India, and also in your work with Data for India, you have worked on different aspects of socio-economic scenario in India. I would encourage people to definitely go check it out at Data for India. So that is dataforindia.com. Lots of insights there. But what I want to know from you is that did you, during this process, did any data completely shock you or take you by surprise in the sense that you completely had a different view of this and then that just turned 180 degrees?
Yeah, so there's a couple of pieces that are already up that have, you know, data points that were a huge, were very surprising to me. Both these pieces have been written by my colleague Abhishek Vaghmare. So one of the pieces is about access to phones in India, which was extremely surprising to me, both phones and internet. And you know, it's not just that not everyone has access to, or not everyone is using a phone. And it's not just not everyone, it's a substantial number of people not using a phone as of 2019-21. But the number in that that is most surprising to me is that 9 out of 10 people who aren't using phones are in households where someone's using a phone. So the issue is not of access. Someone in the household has a phone, but there are still a substantial number of people, the 30% or so, who are not currently using phones, the majority of whom are women. So that particular part of it, that it's not just, so, you know, I think when people think of policy solutions, they'll try and think of maybe a scheme to get more phones into women's hands. But if you are in a household where someone has a phone, but you are still not using one, there are intra-household dynamics potentially to think about. That's one. The other one is, I feel like I have, you know, paid quite a lot of attention to women's labor force participation over the years. And I feel like, you know, broadly, I knew that labor force participation rates are low, and that was the sort of key point there. So when Abhishek, when he writes the piece, he writes about labor force participation, and then he writes about women in the paid workforce. So we're saying, you know, the vast majority of women of working age are not in the paid workforce. Now let's talk about the small share, 20-30%, who are in the paid workforce. 40% of these women, they are in the paid workforce, so they are counted as workers, work for no wages, because they are unpaid workers in household enterprises. Typically in rural areas, this is farm work, family farms, and in urban areas, it is working in the family shop. Now, if it was just a feature of Indian employment that a lot of people work for no wages because they're working in household enterprises, that would be one thing. But it is a hugely gendered thing. It is not 40% for men. It is under 10%. It is single digits for men. So I just thought that, to me, it's not just a surprising number. It sort of advanced the conversation about women's work enormously in my mind. Because talking about how to get women into the paid workforce is one thing. But why do we talk about work? What is the sort of traditional understanding of work? That it is something that brings money into the woman's hand and brings in a level of agency and liberty that you associate with paid work. But if this work is happening within household enterprises for no wages, can we stop the conversation at just bringing women into the workforce? Or do we now have to have a two-pronged conversation about bringing women into the workforce And then bringing women into workforce for wages, which seems like an almost entirely separate dimension to the conversation that India in particular needs to have. So yeah, that really shifted things in my mind quite a lot.
Yeah, that is an extreme level of disparity. I mean, being in the workforce and not getting paid is just, wow, wonderful insights. Well, Rukmini, before we end this podcast, it's 2024. How can we not talk about AI? So I use Perplexity AI quite a bit, and Perplexity is, completely different from ChatGPT or Claude by Anthropic. In the sense that, you ask a question and it's going to give you the answer, probably not provide insights, or probably provide minor insights, but not, extremely beautiful charts, but it's going to give you references. So when there is Perplexity AI, what is the gap that Data for India is going to fill? Just want to understand.
So I think if not just AI, but if all of the, let's take it back even to machine learning and even to one step before that, if any of these tools were able to do two, three things that we've had to do a lot of over the last 10 years, but even in the last year itself, we would not build Data for India. We would think of something else to solve for. But there's these two, three things. One is, the huge amount of so the cleaning that needs to happen of data to make it usable is not purely technical. So it's not that you simply write a script and you can clean it up. There is a huge amount of checking with other things like the questionnaire, the published report that needs to happen. That's one. Two is that there is a language to Indian official data that is all its own, and converting that into English and insights is unfortunately still a specialized skill. None of these, I mean, I don't feel in competition with AI. If AI was able to do this, I think that would be great and would, free up people to do other things. So I'm not trying to say that this is an advantage we have over AI. This is something we unfortunately have to do ourselves. And then three is the level of insight that we're able to produce off this data, particularly by looking at multiple sources and filling in what the shortcomings of current data sources are, is something that very much requires human effort and accumulated knowledge, as well as in a way sort of reporting elements like calling people and trying to understand what's happening. Those still seem currently unautomatable. Parts of this will certainly change. We too are very happy to be able to see what can be done. We're happy to be able to see the advances in visualization that can happen, the assistance with code that can happen, all of that is extremely exciting. And I think what we want to make very sure of is that we're not writing literal descriptions of data that, again, it's not that we see ourselves in competition with AI, but we don't, nobody needs to do that. All of these are skills that another person or another, non-sentient person could do. And we don't want to do that. So we're excited, we're really excited to see, how AI can help us do this better as well. But unfortunately, all of these things are very much these are streams of work that we've had to very slowly work through ourselves at the moment.
Yeah, and like you mentioned, 10 years of work or years and years of experience, and to understand the nuance, and you probably, having worked in this field for such a long time, also understand the pulse and have a lot more contextual information to bring.
That's right. I think being able to compare and sort of contextualize and pull in multiple streams of thought is very important. So one of the things, for example, with health data, one of the lines of criticism of the government during the pandemic was that they're clearly lying or they're suppressing numbers. And my point has always been that we are not able to capture deaths from all diseases. It's very hard to do, and typically, you know, to a large part now happens outside the public healthcare system, for which surveillance doesn't exist. So the way to, you know, put these numbers in context is to be able to compare what surveillance data for that year for one disease showed versus what you know, another government source for the same year showed. So it shows, for example, for the most recent year available, there were 192 officially recorded deaths from malaria, while another government source, the sample registration system, puts that number at 40,000. So that is not, the government is not lying or trying to suppress malaria data, as I believe they did not lie or try to suppress COVID deaths, but it is an inability to, it is a system that is not fully developed and matured yet. It is not able to capture and track all deaths. So this is very important context, I think, and it requires pulling in multiple sources together. So that still seems like something that that we're able to do.
Yeah, wonderful. Rukmini, thank you so much. We did not dive a lot into the data itself, but I wanted to get a glimpse of what the thought process was and what were the steps in building such a monumental website. And it's only going to get bigger and better and more refined over time. So thank you so much for all the work that you have done and you are doing. And I'll be following Data for India pretty closely.
Thanks very much. And as before, I want to shout out my team, because Data for India really is a team effort.
Okay, Rukmini, thank you so much. Really looking forward to how this scales up.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.